All right, hey everybody, Nick Manton here, and I'm really excited to have you on the call. Thanks for your patience. I was just letting a few more people get on the line because the lines are crowded. But I've got a really exciting call for you today here, just an informational, fun kind of brainstorm, and we're gonna do a brain drain on my good friend Jeffrey Hazel here today. So, I really thank you all for getting on the call, and write down questions as we go because you're all on mute in lecture mode, as we call it right now, but I am going to open it up to questions later. So if you think of a question, make sure you write it down, and I'll tell you how you can raise your hand later to actually ask that question. So to get started, before I get started, I'm going to read you guys Jeff's bio because it's extremely impressive, and I could tell you lots of cool things about him, but I would much rather tell you the right things about him. So I'm going to read Jeff's bio, and we'll get started in just a second. So Jeffrey Hazel is a best-selling author, global business celebrity, and sometime cowboy, which we'll get to the cowboy part because I love that. Jeffrey Hazel is a global business celebrity and former Fortune 100 C-suite executive. From small business to international corporations, he has put his creativity and extraordinary entrepreneurial skills into play, launching ventures blending his leadership perspectives, insights into professional development, mass marketing prowess, and affinity for social media. He's a well-traveled public speaker, the author of the best-selling book, The Mirror Test, which you should all definitely check out, celebrity editor to one of the largest circulation business publications, and one of the most compelling figures in global business. Dubbed a born leader by Mark Burnett, none other than Mark Burnett, which is a great guy to say that about you. Jeffrey has successfully leveraged multiple media appearances on programs like Fox Business News, MSNBC's Your Business, and, of course, NBC's Celebrity Apprentice with Donald Trump. Drawing upon an eclectic background in business, buoyed by a stellar track record of keynote speaking and deeply rooted in cowboy lore, Jeffrey energizes his role driving and delivering change. He's a turnaround architect of the highest order, a maverick marketer who delivers scalable campaigns, embraces traditional modes of customer engagement, and possesses a remarkable cachet of mentorship, corporate governance, and brand building. So with that, Jeffrey, welcome to the call, man. How are you?
I am wonderful. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. It's going to be a lot of fun today.
Absolutely. We're here for I guess, multiple reasons, but one of the big reasons is to have fun. So, you know, I got a lot of questions I want to ask you, but obviously what I would say most people, are intrigued by is the fact that you're the chief marketing officer of Kodak. And I guess I think what everyone on the call wants to talk about there is, and now really you're in the entrepreneurial world, and I know that, you know, what I know of your story, you've kind of always been an entrepreneur. So would you mind kind of telling us about, you know, I don't know, do you consider yourself a serial entrepreneur? And if so, how did you end up in such a big company role?
Well, I do consider myself an entrepreneur. In fact, that's the things I always go to. I mean, no matter what I see or wherever I'm at, I'm always looking for how you can make money with it and do it in different ways, and that's always been very exciting for me. And there's no difference between Main Street and Wall Street, I like to say, except for the numbers of zeros behind, you know, the number. And if you look at it that way, I mean, for me to go from, you know, a small company in South Dakota, which is I was running a three-person public relations firm, although I owned a couple of franchises as well, the difference was, you know, I went from, you know, so let's say I had 27 employees to 27,000 employees. Again, it's just zeros. And I really looked at it like a startup. For Kodak, it was like a restart.
Yeah.
So it was very much like a startup mentality, except that it already had some assets there and I already had some things there that we could use, but I really didn't see much difference between the two.
Very, very interesting. And so what? Tell us a little bit about the state Kodak was in kind of when you got there. Obviously, I, from my understanding, they had been kind of reeling from the digital, you know, the conversion to digital. So tell us, is that true? Tell us a little bit about what it was like when you got there.
Yeah, well, they're still reeling from that. you know, I mean, there's a company that was, you know, its heyday, you know, had more market cap than all the, you know, car manufacturers in the world combined. So when you look at it, it was a, you know, it's a massive company with, you know, I think a couple hundred thousand employees at one time. Today with about, I don't know, 15,000-20,000 employees, it's a fraction of what it used to be. But it was still a very positive brand, had a lot of brand value, and that was pretty cool. The mood when we jumped into the company, I mean, we were part of the turnaround team, and you know, who's to say if it's going to really survive the way it's supposed to, but certainly. What we did was add a lot more time and months to the end of the life of the company, and extend that out and give them a shot. I mean, a lot of the time when you get to a company, everybody's, you know, it's part of a transformation. They're transformation fatigue, all worn down, and to a point where they, you know, don't know what they're going to do and how they're going to do it. And so all we had to do was go in and change the mood, and that's a big part of what guys like myself do, and I think a lot of entrepreneurs and a lot of, you know, your fans and the people that are listening in this call do. You've really got to get in there and change the mood and change the way in which you're thinking, because they think, you know, all my best days are behind me. Well, you know, you can't think that way. If you think that way, you're dead. You're just not going to be able to move, and you're going to pass my mirror test, for instance. You're not going to fog the mirror, and you really have to say, no, look, you know, I like the way I used to look when I was 20, but I look better now, you know? I'm just never going to look like that again, so I'm going to look different. I'm going to look like the new me, and the new me is better. So, and that's what you have to kind of bring to a company like that, and bring the sense of, you know, we can do it. We can make things happen. Let's just get it going.
I couldn't agree more. So that's really intriguing. So I didn't know that. So you really were kind of an entrepreneur brought into Kodak. You didn't climb the ranks in any way.
No, not at all. In fact, I never worked for a big company like that in my life. I worked for another, you know, a $2 billion company, but even then I was out buying up other companies, putting them together, rolling them up, and reorganizing them. And then, you know, taking the company public, so very much, you know, very entrepreneur as well. I was learning a lot of the rules and regulations as I went, which got me in a lot of trouble sometimes, you know, because I don't like a lot of rules and regulations.
As an entrepreneur and a cowboy, I can imagine those are two things, rules and regulations, that aren't on your to-do list. Tell me this.
Yeah, I hate the man, even when I am the man.
That's funny. So tell me this, it sounds like a story thing to happen to somebody. So you're running a successful business. Obviously, you've done a lot of successful things as we're hearing your story kind of unfold. It sounds like something that a lot of people on this call might say, man, I wish that would happen to me. I wish someone would come to me, pluck me out of the business I'm running right now, because we all have headaches in our business, right? Pluck me out of it. Pay me a great salary and put me in a role like that at a company that, you know, the credibility is just through the roof, huge company. Would you do that again or not?
I don't know that I would do it again, because I'm in a different part of my life where I don't need to do it again. not that I didn't like it or anything else. I mean, come on, now I'm being called this, you know, global business celebrity and celebrity CMO. Someone called me today, Hazlett equals marketing beast. I thought that was interesting. In a tweet, I never recall that. I mean, the Chuck Norris of marketing, I got called, but I can't do that anymore, because Chuck Norris called and said, stop saying that. Anyway, just joking. But, you know, would I do it again? I don't know. I've been offered a lot of other CMO jobs, a lot of CEO jobs, a lot of different public companies, and I like doing what I'm doing. I'm happy with what I'm doing for my wife and I, it's comfortable for what we want to do and the way in which you want to do, and you have to do it for different reasons, and you need to find those things out. So I'm, you know, when you say that, would I consider it? Yeah, I consider it. But it was a dream come true. I mean, to go work for one of the biggest brands in the world, most iconic brands in the world, be a marketing guy, and be working, you know, for, you know, my own small little company, and then obviously get the call. You know, it's kind of like the guy who always wants to be a professional pitcher. And he gets the call. You know, he gets the call. I mean, and by the way, this is even, you know, people talking about, this is really cool, Nick, to be able to talk about this, because I didn't think about this until the last year, as I've been away from the corporate planes and all the perks and everything else that you typically get with this stuff.
Right.
And I miss it, by the way. but it's okay. I just have to make enough to get my own plane and everything else. As you think about this thing, and you think about how tough it is to be a pro athlete, you know, it's even tougher to break in the top 100, top 200 of the C-suite of business. And it's even higher odds than being a pro athlete.
Wow.
When you think about it. It's
so
a very small club.
Tougher, huh?
Think about it, you know, there's 5 to 10 of those, you know, in every company, and let's say it's 100, okay?
Yep.
So that's 1,000 people. Well, there's more pro athletes than that, you know. So there's more pro football players than that. So when you start thinking about stuff like that, you go like, wow, how cool was that? and I really do. I mean, it was really cool. I mean, it was awesome. But at the same time, let me be clear, it was also the hardest thing I've ever done. It was the most intellectually stimulating thing I've ever done in terms of learning and having a blast and just enjoying myself. But I pushed myself. I worked, you know, 20 hours a day, which I still do today. But right. a different kind of work, you know, different kind of work.
Got that. Cool. All right, so we're going to get back in a little bit, too, to kind of what you're doing today. So I'm sure we'll get some of that peppered in, too. But, you know, as an entrepreneur, being that you've been an entrepreneur all your life, I mean, what do you think biggest mistake, couple biggest mistakes that you've seen people make?
Oh, well, I think the biggest things that we do is that we go off and do things without asking why we're in the game. You know, we should constantly be asking ourselves, why are we doing it? What's the things we want to drive? What conditions of satisfaction do we want to drive from any of our action, whether it be, you know, advertising, launching a new product, hiring a new staff person? And I don't think we ask the right kinds of questions, and we think it might be cool to do, or we like the person, or whatever it might be. And I think we have to spend a lot more time, you know, really getting to know, you know, why is it we're doing what we're doing, and then measure ourselves against that to go back to. I mean, it's, for instance, Nick, right now I won't do something if it doesn't meet three criteria. And when you ask me about when I go back and do it again, my three criteria, quite frankly, are real simple. I have to have fun. If I don't have fun, I'm not interested. I have to build wealth for my family. So if I can't have a chance to make, you know, money, and so well, that's not everything, but, well, I'm, quite frankly, that's how you keep score. And then the third thing is grow professionally. And those are the three things that meet my criteria. And so even when I'm working with new clients now, new companies that want to have high growth, and they hire the Hazlett Group, for instance, or we invest in their company or help them with their public relations and their marketing strategies, I'm not interested if I can't meet those three criteria. And so I think a lot of businesses and a lot of business owners get in there without asking those tough questions. That's the reason I wrote the book, The Mirror Test. And it didn't make a difference whether you're on Wall Street or you're on Main Street, whether you're a Fortune 100, Fortune 500 officer, or you're running a new startup, or, you know, a new hot dog stand. Ask yourself some really hard questions before you go out and do that stuff. And a lot of people just don't do that. They're afraid to, you know. But they don't know. Or they don't know, maybe. And maybe they could be the thing, too.
Yeah, I agree. And so in that book, you talk about, you know, conditions of satisfaction. Are these your conditions of satisfaction, or are they something else?
No, I mean, those are my personal conditions of satisfaction, but I have other ones. Conditions of satisfaction are the things, I call them mutual conditions of satisfaction, by the way. So if you're in everything that we do, I'm looking at Peter's name because Peter's trying to buzz me. He's a CMO of Macy's. The CMO of Macy's is trying to reach me right now, so I'm going to ignore him. Because I'm going to ignore him because it's more fun to talk to you guys. So if you were to hire me, or I were to hire you, in everything we do, there's a customer and there's a performer. And when we agree that I'm going to do something for you, we're going to outline condition satisfaction. So I'm going to do this, and then what? And if I do this, what do I get out of it? And let's be clear about what those are. And let's make sure that implied contract is really stated out and have that communication. And by doing that, then there's no ambiguity in terms of what's being delivered, how and when, at what quality, you know, at what frequency, you know, at what intensity, you know, and so forth and so on. So I don't think people do that. And when they don't have that transparency and that clarity, then they sometimes get things mixed up. I use an example all the time when my speeches were, I pull up to McDonald's, I shout my order out to the speaker, pull up to the first window, pay my money, I get up the second window, and I'm expecting my food, and they open the window, and we'll see if this ever happened to you. They lean out and say, I'm sorry, your order's not quite ready.
Yeah.
And they said, but if you pull over to this parking lot or parking spot over here, we'll bring it out to you. And that happens to a lot of people, I'm sure, on this call. And whenever it's happened, I say, no, I'm not pulling over there. And they say, well, sir, you're going to hold things up. I don't care. I mean, I don't care. And I roll my window back up. And pretty soon a 14-year-old assistant manager comes over and knocks on my window and says, is there an issue? I think, look, we made a pact. We made conditions of satisfaction. I gave you my order. I gave you my money. You took it. I'm here at the window. I'm not taking it. Now, unless you want to change the conditions of satisfaction, which you want to give me one of those minty shakes or one of those apple pies I like so much, you know, I'm not pulling over there. And until then, I'm going to sit right here and I roll my window up. Well, now when I go to McDonald's, I mean, I shout out my order, they get it, I give my money, And then I put the second window, and my food is thrown through the window, you know, as I'm driving by. And that's setting conditions of satisfaction. And you know, some people say, well, Jeff, is that a South Dakota thing? Is that a cowboy thing? I said, well, I don't know. I just think that's a good business thing. And that's being direct and being, you know, very clear about what I want and what you want. And if we do that more often with our employees, our vendors, even our family, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
How much easier it can be.
And those are – most people get uncomfortable in that situation because those are hard discussions to have. It's hard to be that direct with somebody. But I think what people have to understand is when you're doing it because you actually give a damn, that's where you could say no problem and never go back again. But you really want to do well, so you make them learn a lesson, right? So
mm-hmm.
That's cool.
Yeah, without question. And the more you do that with your vendors, your partners, your partners. I mean, I've been in a lot of partner deals where, you know, we go through things like I have a partner now in my business today, and you know, I'm sitting down with his wife and he this weekend, and my wife to make sure that we know we have all the death benefit things in place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's going to happen if I die? What's going to happen to the business? If he dies, what will happen to the business? And
right.
and we have hard conversations like, you know, to his wife, who I love, and to my wife, who I love, and I know he loves her like a sister, and so forth and so on. We don't want them involved in the business, okay? You know, we did this business, and we all have roles to play in our lives and our relationships. And so we have conversations around when if I die, this money goes to my wife, this money goes into the business, and my wife is out of it. She's not
right.
involved,
right.
You know, and so forth and so on. So. And those are tough conversations, but ones that you need to make sure that you have, because you want to be clear, you know, want to be clear. You want no ambiguity left later on. So what's the governance? What's the things that you can put forth in that?
I love that. And I think what again, I'd like most people to understand is, look, I'm sure, for instance, being at Kodak probably really pushed your comfort level in certain areas of things that, whether it was this or not, this kind of meeting or not, but probably really pushed it to a point that, but once you go through experiences like that, you realize, hey, this is not a bad thing to do. This is a great thing to do. It's just, it was outside of my comfort zone, so I thought it wasn't, I just didn't know what to do with it. I kind of hid it in the dark sides of my mind and said, you know, it's not that important. But as you push yourself and stretch yourself, and when you truly are going into it with, you know, with good motives, because there's a reason why you all are going to sit down. But you have to frame it for your wife, too. I mean, I know that. I mean, hey, we're sitting down because we all care. We're not trying to figure out how to cut our wives out of business. But it's really important to have those conversations. But I love the fact that you bring that up, because I think, again, things like that are just so far outside of people's comfort zones, they just don't really know where to go with it, so they just don't do anything. So my push there to everybody is just, you know, think through these things, because that's so important. And, you know, to get yourself, even if it is a little bit out of your comfort zone, it's like a business prenup. I mean, it makes sense. So I love that. Well, let's talk for a second about your best-selling book, The Mirror Test. Some more. You know, you write and speak frequently on the importance of social media and technology and marketing. And I know you brought a lot of that to Kodak, who obviously had not much of it. So tell us a little bit about that, about kind of social media and technology and marketing.
Well, I mean, social media has been around forever. I love all these people talking about, well, social media is so new, and it's not. It's been around forever. It drives me crazy sometimes listening to all these pundits. I don't know where all these social media people came from before,
right?
But they're really talking about a platform, you know,
right.
A fax machine, a different way. I mean, did we stop listening to our customers before? I mean, I don't think we did as well, because we used 800 numbers, these torturous, telephone trees where push 1 for this, 5 for this, and 6 for this. We tried to force our customers into doing business with us the way that we wanted to rather than the way they wanted to. And now what's happening with social media platforms and this phenomena of social media, which has been nothing more than customers are now being able to be heard, they just weren't being heard before. And so now, by doing the way they're doing it, they're able to amplify their message. And so for businesses, this is a great opportunity. I made the comment this morning, I was given a keynote, that if you suck before, okay, in a traditional world, you will suck more online, okay? And it'll just be more people will now be able to see it, okay, because more people have access to you. So, and it will travel, and that sucky business practice that you did before will now travel at warp speed. So, and that's what you have to keep in mind. So, you know, my strategy around this is, like, I call it the four E's. You have to, first of all, engage with your customers, which you need to do, and any good business should be doing that. And by engagement, you're going to be listening more. I mean, I put in the very first chief listening officer ever of a company. I put in the very first chief blogger. If you heard that term, chief blogger, I invented that, I think, in 2006, I think it was the first chief blogger was named, and I named the first one at a big corporation. And then I named the first chief listening officer, and that wasn't some publicity gimmick. It was somebody act like an air traffic controller and have to listen to every conversation, because I don't think you can do that. But in a small business, I mean, you got to be the chief executive officer and president, and you probably clean the toilets, and you probably got to be the chief listener too. You know,
yeah.
And I've been there, done that, still do that, and on all of the above.
Yeah.
And so you want to engage, and by engaging, then you start to educate. They educate you, you educate them, you start listening more and start paying attention to what they're doing and what they want, and that they want this, they want that. You start sending trends, if they suggest product innovations for you. And then what happens is people start getting excited. When they get excited, they start to evangelize, and that's when it becomes really cool. And so this is a great tool for business, certainly a great tool for people and their families and everything else. I mean, that's the reason I do my tweeting. That's the reason I do my Facebook and things more for my family and not my fans. But I still do a lot of stuff privately that a lot of people don't see, just because that's how I got started with it.
Very cool. And you also, I love the fact that, I know you emphasize that marketing is not just about one solution, and I beat this into people's heads every day. I mean, for example, I mean, companies obviously shouldn't just focus on social media, the new platforms, but they need to take advantage of other marketing mediums like, you know, print and direct mail and audio and video. I mean, let's talk about that for a minute.
I'm sorry, you cut out. What was that?
No, yeah, I was just saying that I know you emphasize a lot that people shouldn't just use one solution, and I do the same thing, one marketing solution. And a lot of people now want to drop everything else and go straight to social media platforms. But I know you talk about the things like taking advantage of other mediums like print and direct mail and video,
yeah,
audio, other mediums as well.
Yeah, those things are dead. I mean, everyone likes the new shiny object. I mean, there's no doubt about that. They always want to go to that. But that's not what you should do. If you're a good marketer and you're a good business person, you're going to use every tool that's in your arsenal. And so, we use a hunting analogy. I use a rifle when I need to shoot long range, and I need a shotgun when I need to shoot up close. And so it just depends on what you're going for and how you want to get it. And so I would tend to want a blended campaign. I would tend to want to look at, you know, from a blended perspective, and then see which tools I want to use based on, you know, my audience. And so that's what I would tell any marketer to do, and I'd use every tool that's at my arsenal. That would be the most effective.
Absolutely. There's really, yeah, as we've distilled it down and made a list, I mean, there's probably many lists out there. We figured out 22 different channels of media, and most businesses are only using one. If you use two, it usually will double your business. Not everyone's going to work well, but, I mean, think about if you those of you on the call, if you expand your business into 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 channels of media, your business will go through the roof, because it's just other ways to communicate with prospects and clients. I mean, one of the lessons I continually find out over and over again, you know, I got a lot of people on the call today from an email. Well, a lot of times, you know, people send a lot of emails. We send a lot of emails. Not everybody has time to read them all. Sometimes they hit the spam filter, all that stuff. And it's always shocking to me that every time I follow up with a piece of direct mail, my response is so much better. I get a lot of response from email, but I always get an additional response, an additional wave of response from direct mail. And now, you know, we do a lot of multi-sequence direct mail and email and faxing and voice broadcast. I mean, all that kind of stuff, because the more channels you use, the more likely someone's going to catch it. They're going to hear it, whether they weren't listening at first or it just never got to them, because, quite frankly, that happens so often. I mean, one of my biggest frustrations right now is, you know, one of the things I really try to do is anytime someone mentions me on Twitter, I just think it's good manners to say thanks. And I'm having so many times now where even, you know, my Twitter monitoring applications are missing on picking up the fact that someone mentioned me. So I actually have a second column now, like in Hootsuite, where instead of just my mentions, I search my name too, and I find probably half as many times Hootsuite picked it up as they didn't. And I'm not picking on them. I think they got a great service. But, you know, I'm sure they're all the same. But, you know, just with the amount of noise going on online, even if you are trying hard to pay attention attention to things. There's so many times when it doesn't all come through because there's just so much clutter, so many walls for it to go through, that I think it's so important to use just as many channels of media that are effective in your business as you can. And again, I guarantee you most people on the line here are using 1, 2, maybe at the most 3. I'd say 90% of people are using less than 2 or 3 channels of media, which is scary, and you have a huge room to grow.
Yeah, we used to just use Yellow Pages, so imagine how far we've come. You know, so,
exactly. And you know, I think you can get a pretty good deal on Yellow Pages right now.
Yeah, well, there's some businesses they can still thrive from that, and that's a good medium for them to use. And Yellow Pages, quite frankly, has really taken over a lot of stuff online in terms of searching for people. Getting back to your point about using different things, I mean, that's just something you should do. By the way, I'll give you one other hint you might want to do. For those that are out there that are using it, you go, oh, I search my mentions and find out. You just gave another one about just use your name. And then the next one I use is misspell your name and search for that too. Certainly with my name, which is Hazlett, H-A-Y-Z-L-E-T-T, some people miss that and they'll type it differently. But if, you know, so I'll spell it differently and I'll pick up other things that people say, which is kind of nice.
And while you're talking about that, what are your favorite tools for monitoring social media right now?
I use a couple of different tools. Like, we use People Browser pretty heavily here. We use Radian 6. Radian 6 is another tool we've used.
Okay.
I also use Uber Tweet on my BlackBerry, which I use pretty heavily. I don't know what else. We've got a bunch of other tools that we use that the team uses, and I'm not as good at as they are.
Got that. Cool. And let's talk for a minute. A lot of people get scared of social media and digital marketing because they don't understand how to track the ROI of it. You know, the ROI is seems a bit elusive. Can you speak a bit about that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, so when people start talking to me about what's the ROI on this, I said, I don't know, what's the return on ignoring? This is your customers talking. It doesn't mean you have to. And to me, this is also the biggest use of OPM I've ever seen in my life, other people's money. And so this is a great way for you to be able to get engaged with these guys and get business from it. And you can get business. I don't care if you're a B2C company or a B2B company, you get business from this stuff. My number one lead source for the stuff that I do comes from Twitter. Second is LinkedIn, and then third would be Facebook. And Google Plus, I haven't seen that yet, but there's only 25 million people that are part of that. And those are mostly insiders, so it's not out to the masses yet. I want to add some more tools. Seismic is another tool. Hootsuite's one we use. TweetDeck is another one.
Yep.
So you use lots of different tools for different things.
Yep, got that. Figure out what it's good at and use it for that and keep as many quick tools in your arsenal as possible. Cool. I want to open up the questions in a minute, but just before we get into that, I mean, what are you working on these days? I've heard you got another book coming out. Tell us about that and just tell us kind of what the projects you're working on these days.
Yeah, I've got another book called The Gauntlet to talk about all the things I couldn't say in the first book, so I could finally say about this, and that's about driving change in your organization. You know, people talk about being change agents. They want to be a change agent, and I've been described as that. I mean, the longest place I ever stayed in one particular time has been Kodak, which was 4 years. And typically a CMO only stays about 18 to 23 months. That's the average lifespan of a chief marketing officer. So I stayed there for quite a long time, almost twice the time span of someone who shouldn't have probably stayed there that long. I was only going to stay there a couple of years. But anyway, to be a change agent in the company, it takes a special breed of person. It takes a special kind of gift and a special attitude. And so I strive to write that in my new book called Running the Gauntlet, which will be out in January. But right now we're still supporting the Mirror Test. The Mirror Test is still doing well. It was last year Inc. Magazine's number one business book, and of course been a Wall Street Journal bestseller, New York Times, USA Today. So we've been real excited by the designations that we've got from the bestseller list. And we lead the Hazlett Group, and we work with high-growth companies, those companies that want to move to high growth, whether they're a few million dollars or a few billion dollars. And so we're working with those and recently just purchased the Idea Network, which is a company that is a public relations firm, which we've merged in. into a company called Tallgrass, which is Tallgrass Public Relations, and we're working with authors and thought leaders and a number of businesses on making sure they get their fair share of media coverage.
Awesome. Well, all sounds really exciting, and certainly we'll everybody on the call needs to run out and buy The Mirror Test, a great book, and as well as check out your new book coming out. If anyone has a question, go ahead and dial star 2 right now. Dial star 2 to raise your hand, and I will unmute you and call on you. And don't be bashful. Jeff's happy to answer some questions, so do that. So, again, dial star 2 if you've got any questions. And I see our first question coming in right now. It looks like we've got one from the name on the line says Frank Smith. Is this Frank we got in the line?
No, this is Mark, but I do the advertising for Frank.
Hey, Mark, how are you, man?
Good. Hey, good going. Hey, I got a question, and I know Kodak has been around a while, but I don't see that. So my question is I work for a company, and you know we're always wanting to promote over 45 years in the community. Does Kodak, they don't have any concerns about how long they've been in business, and do you think that people just don't care anymore, and that's more of a mute point?
Well, you mean in terms of, you're talking about the length of they've been in as a company?
Yeah, like, you know, Kodak, and I just recently bought some of your products for my daughter going to college, but I know it's been around a long time, but a lot of people don't. And like I said, I promote our company serving the community for over 45 years, and I don't know of Kodak and a lot of other companies that does that. So do you think it's important to let people know how long the company has been around or no?
Well, you know, it depends. I mean, certainly Kodak's been around for 119 years. That's a pretty long time for a company. But
awful
does that make
long,
you want to buy the camera? Does that make you want to buy the printer? Does that make you want to buy the product that much more? I think once you get to a certain level of maturity as a company, people pretty much know you've been around forever, you know, older than dirt, so to speak. So I don't know that it becomes a value statement that's a differentiation between somebody else, unless, of course, you're trying to differentiate yourself against someone who might be fly-by-night and less established. So if you're in a marketplace where you've got a competitor that's less established and maybe is a risk for the person, so if you choose that company, it's not a really good decision on your part. You know, you don't want to say that to them. Because, you know, they might not have the money to support you, they might be out of business next year and so forth. So therefore saying, hey, I've been in business for 47 years, that's a good thing. Or if it's a service business, that's a trust business. You know what I mean? In terms of, you know, we come into your house and so forth and so on, you can trust us, like an electrician or plumber and some of those. Those to me would be an area where I would do that. I'd have
right.
to look at the value statement, you know, somewhere else to say that would be a great value that makes me want to do business with you for that. It's certainly something to know, and I think, on your website, this is an area you could promote, talk about your history, talk about the things so that people can see that side of the story for those that are interested, though. I don't know if it's your value statement. I would use different value statements typically.
Cool. Yes, we have other value statements. But anyway, thank you very much. That's good. Do you promote that any way through Kodak, that you guys have been around for 119 years?
Well, I mean, when I was at Kodak, I did some of that in some areas where I thought it was, you know, especially when I would talk about the breadth and history, when I started to explain the transformation the company was going through. And I certainly do it in my speeches, because one of the sections I say is like, what would George do? And so I wanted to take it back to the founding principles of the company. And so I would really start to delve into the history and show people that history, and then show how he made the company and then how innovative he was and how we pulled that innovation all the way through to today. Then 119 years later, look how innovative we are by following these same principles. So one, he said, you know, push one button and do the rest. Okay, this is what it means to our products today. Make cameras as easy as using a pencil, okay? This is what it means today. You know what I mean?
So
So with those two things, when you start talking about that, then you want to frame it in saying, George Eastman said these things 119 years ago. They're just as relevant today, and this is what it means today in today's technology. So a camera that has an easy share button on it that says push this one button, and it has smart capture, and there on your camera today, you have 90 some different settings on your camera for inside, outside, close up, flowers, facial. And we built the 10 most used features and put them in the one button so that you don't have to set that camera. You know, that makes, and then tie that back to the principle, you can see what I'm talking about.
Great question.
Absolutely.
Thanks for calling in, man. We appreciate it. And I'd second that in just saying that. I think don't just use it blindly. Use it when it makes sense, because there's certainly been times when companies like Kodak or, you know, Blue Cross, Blue Shield Insurance, whatever, will kind of, some of the commercials will kind of bring that, I call it like a hearth feeling, like a family hearth, a nostalgic feeling back to things. So there's
a time
to do it, but don't just do it blindly, you know.
Yeah, Nick, I used to be on the operating board, review board for Northwestern Mutual. I mean, here's a billion dollar plus company.
Right.
You know, I'm putting my money in. I want to know they've been around for a long time.
That makes a big difference. Good point. All right, cool. Got some more questions lining up. Again, if you want to ask a question, dial star 2. And we'll get to you here in a second, but dial star 2 to go ahead and get yourself in line. I got Michael Diadamo on the line. Michael, what's going on, my man?
Hey, I'm here. How you doing, Nick? How you doing, Jeff? Thank you for the call. I had two quick questions. One is we first brought up the four E's. I don't think you completed what those four E's were, and I did want to know them.
I did. I left them hanging out there for you because I want you to buy the book and read it, but I'll give them to you again. It's really about engagement. The second one is about education. The third one's about getting people excited. And when they get excited, it leads to the fourth one, which they start to evangelize. And so those are the four E's, and I describe those more in depth. You can actually, if you search online, you'll see me with a number of different videos and so forth where I'll talk about that, and you'll find it. But otherwise, it's also in the book.
Okay. My second question was, originally started my business for first decade, I was real protected of my internet image, and Nick has been the person that I've worked with now to launch this internet image. Every single thing now about finding me on the internet has been now working through Nick, and that's increased now as we're going to be working on some other projects, and I like the way it's rolling out. So my question is this, is if you have a business that's 15 years old and does well, but then you're also, your personal status is also one of the driving forces of that business, what do you think is better to attack the social media market with, you or your business?
Well, this is a great, great piece. In fact, I close my book with this chapter, and I'll sum it up by saying, sell you and you sell the business. Sell yourself and you sell the business. Most people are doing business with people, not necessarily the company, and it's the relationships that they have with those people. So, you know, there was a headline that I was termed the celebrity apprentice by Forbes magazine. They wrote a big article on me at one time. And the headline said, I can't remember the headline, but it's in the book again. I apologize. I've been traveling like crazy. But Jeff, I think it said something along the lines, Jeff Hazlett's all the rage online, but is he doing more than selling his company? Is he selling himself? And went on to say that, you know, that really what a guy like me does is sell himself to sell the company. That I would use any tool in my arsenal to be able to sell it. And if all I have right then is to sell me, to sell the company, and my enthusiastic, you know, opinion of the company and so forth, that's what we do. So it was a pretty cool article. I just didn't like the headline. And I think that's the way most small businesses and most businesses, when I see you walk into a restaurant, I see you, but I see the business. And I don't think they're interchangeable, I mean, or exclusive to one another. I think they're very interchangeable. So you run some risk with that, okay? But, you know, a brand is nothing but a promise delivered, and you're part of the promise and thing that you're delivering. So to me, they're uniquely tied together, and I think you should be selling yourself. And I think when you talk about getting involved on Twitter and you get involved in social media in a lot of cases, I think those have to be people. And so it can't just be, you know, XYZ company. So I would really push you to get very, very active and very upfront about that stuff.
Very cool. Great question, Michael, and great to hear you, man. I'm sure I will see you soon. Jeff, I'm going to do one more question. Actually, this one came in through email, and I think I know your answer, but I love the question. You know, obviously, being the CMO of Kodak as well as, you know, a big online presence, obviously not, and just as you mentioned in that article, you know, you're not always going to get people aren't always going to say what you want them to say, and it's going to hang out there for a while. There's nothing you can really do about it. How do you deal with criticism both online and offline, but particularly, I'd say, in the social media sphere?
I just sum it up, they can bite me. I mean, I mean, everybody's entitled to their opinion. I love it. That's what makes our country great. That's what makes democracy great. And you can say whatever you want. And people are cruel. I hope you got enough guts to say it to me to my face. I hope you're coming from an educated perspective and so forth. I hope that you would like to have a healthy debate. But I find a lot of people are you know, that make a lot of these comments, quite frankly, hide behind unregistered names and so forth and so on. And then people are vocal about, you know, my role at Kodak. They're vocal about the leadership in companies. I mean, good, knock yourself out. You know, no one's going to die, you know, from that perspective. So here's what I've always learned. I've been a speaker for a long time. I've spoken at audiences. And, you know, you can't believe your own stuff. Press releases. You can't believe your standing ovations all the time. And so here's what I do. I take the bottom 10%, I throw it out. The top 10%, I throw it out. And what's left is pretty much what I got. And that's just the way I've always gone with it. I don't try to believe too much of the good stuff, and I don't try to believe the bad stuff all too. Is there hints of truth in some of it? Sure there is. I mean, otherwise it would be said. But I don't. I know who I am. I know what I'm doing. I know where I want to go. And thank goodness my mom and dad raised me well enough to know I'm comfortable with myself. And I don't try to take myself, and luckily I've got a great spouse, and I've got a great staff and great friends who try not to make sure I don't get too big for my own britches sometimes.
Love it. Very cool, Jeff. Hey, if people want to learn more about you, the Mirror Test, tweet with you, give us some contact info.
Yeah, I mean, just go to hazelett.com, HAYZLETT. If you just type in Hazelett, there's not too many of us. You'll find me, and you can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on LinkedIn. That's me. I'm the one that's doing it. I'm the one responding. I got a good team to help me out from time to time. You can find us at HAYZLETT. The name is Jeffrey Hazelett.
Awesome. Well, hey, Jeff, thanks a ton for your time, man. I know everyone on the call really enjoyed it. Everybody else, I hope you will continue to follow Jeff and see what he's up to. I always enjoy my time with him. Jeff, I'm sure I'll see you in L.A. at Sang or something else here soon in the next few months. But, hey, man, good luck to everything you're doing, and thanks a ton for spending some time with us.
Hey, thanks, everybody, and tune in, and we'll keep going, and I appreciate it very much, Nick.
All right, take care.